Welcome to the Cauldron Series with Dr. Barry Goff, a deep dive into the turbulent and transformative decades of British Columbia's past. In this episode, we turn our attention to communications, the lifelines of a growing province in the late 19th and early 20th century. As British Columbia emerged from isolation and pushed towards modernity, the arrival of telegraphs, postal routes, and eventually wireless signals reshaped how people connected across vast, rugged landscapes. Dr. Goff explores how these evolving networks influence politics, commerce, and community, and how the struggle to communicate mirrored the struggle to define British Columbia's place in a changing Canada. Without further ado, Dr. Barry Goff and communications during the Cauldron.
I'm Barry Goff, and I'm glad that you're joining us today for another episode in the Cauldron series. I've called it the Cauldron series because it's the most exciting and energetic period of British Columbia history. It begins in the year 1871 with British Columbia being entered into the Union of Dominion of Canada, and it ends with the coming of the opening shots of the Great War in 1914. There's so much that comes into action at the same compressed time: immigration, shipping, railways, importation of workers, union problems, crisis in management, the need to defend Esquimalt when the Royal Navy has left, the rise of local militias, etc., etc., to say nothing, of course, of the agricultural, fishing, and lumbering development of British Columbia. I'm excited about this series because I think it's been glossed over so very quickly in the rush from the Confederation achievement to getting into the First World War, and then out of that and then into a interwar period. So this is why I am regarded as a highly complex and highly detailed period. And I'm glad that you're listening to it, because I don't think historians have attended to the complexities of this. Of course, in my situation as the interlocutor between the past and the present, I can only do one theme at a time. But I'm going to make parallel and lateral references to other things as we go through this particular episode. Our subject is communication. That is to say, interpersonal information exchange for the purposes of family ties and linkages, of reporting of travels, of building businesses, of conducting things quicker and faster. And throughout this period, 1871-1914, we go through tremendous changes. Now, I'm going to start this by telling a very brief story about how things used to be. Now, the Hudson Bay Company was running a wonderful shipping service here on the British Columbia coast in the 1840s. But when it was decided to shift the headquarters of the HBC from Fort Vancouver on the Columbia River north to Victoria on Camosun Inlet, the whole removal of the headquarters had to be arranged. And I've been reading about how James Douglas, who is the head of the Western Department of the Hudson Bay Company, and his family and their holdings in gold, their big stocks of furs that they took away from Fort Vancouver in their exodus. It's a story of an exodus, actually, now that I think of it, and also other supplies, including their horses and their wagons and their furniture and so forth. And they left Fort Vancouver. They traveled through the Cowlitz Passage, just beyond the Great Mount St. Helens, and then they came through some muddy areas and then down to this sheep grazing agricultural plain at Nisqually, which is at the south end of Puget Sound. There they were boarded the little brigantine Cadbury, one of our famous early ships of this coast. And from there they made, it's hard to believe, but it was an 8-day passage to get from there to Victoria through stormy seas. Everybody was ill on board, And they finally arrived in Victoria after this momentous a voyage. Nowadays, executive travel for a person as important of James Douglas would be done by Learjet or by helicopter, and he'd be there in an hour and a half or 2 hours across the same 45 miles. But in those days, when you took your family and your goods and your possessions, it was a huge, horrendous trip. And it was totally dependent upon good navigation. And safely, they got into Victoria Harbor. When they arrived, there were the Hudson Bay Company's guns boomed out because they knew Governor Douglas was there and is to greet his family. And immediately they were brought into the care and attention of Roderick Finlayson, who was running the post at Fort Victoria. It's intriguing to know that at that time, Douglas was the governor as far as the HBC was concerned. And it wasn't until a few months later that he was told, "Sorry, you're not governor. Richard Blanchard is coming to take your place. He's been properly appointed. He's got the Queen's Commission." In this interval, the officers of the Hudson Bay Company, the factors and chief factors, factors and chief traders, called Douglas governor. And that runs through the correspondence you can find in the Ptolemy papers in the Washington State Historical Society. So it's intriguing that it gives us a glimpse of the difference between what was happening on the spot and what was happening in London, because there was such a difference in the distance and the time overland, so to speak. Now let's have a look at how communications occurred in the earliest days, in the prehistoric days before this. The greatest theory for the arrival of indigenous peoples in North America is by way of a land bridge. There were several great ice ages, and it is believed that the area that was called Beringia was the way of passage, and the passage would have taken place from Siberia across this land bridge, the remnant of which is the Aleutian Islands. Then it would come in down into the Rocky Mountain trenches. And indeed, reading Alberta history recently, as I have, there is a long old track or old highway that runs along the eastern portions of the flanks of the Rocky Mountains. And it was the great north-south highway of the times. Maybe you can still find remnants of it. I'd be interested to know if you can. But it ran along that flank, and it that the general argument has been that the indigenous nations were not indigenous in the sense that they came out of the ground. They were indigenous in the sense that they were the first arrivals. And many students of this subject believe that they came farther south, maybe down into Mexico, and then some of them came back to cooler and more equitable climes where it was perhaps greater game, and then began to set down in their villages. But these were people who went at different times, and we need to be reminded that in British Columbia, there's seven different Indigenous language entities, so they came at different times. In the New World, all fossil human bones so far discovered have been classified as Homo sapiens sapiens, that is, doubly wise men. And the subspecies to all forms of man belong to this. It's obvious that until man had evolved into a full-fledged human being with the ability to make fire, fur, clothing, and semi-subterranean houses, and to acquire and capture Arctic game, he could not have lived in the Arctic climate of Siberia or to have made his way over the land bridge in the New World. Although in the preceding tertiary epoch, there were warmer periods which made it possible for monkeys to get to South America. This was before any form of man existed, and the records show that these monkeys did not serve as the springboard for evolution upward to man in the New World. I'm reading from the distinguished Harold E. Driver's Indians of North America, which is the classic work published by Chicago University. One more sentence from him. There is abundant evidence of the presence of man in the New World as early as about 10,000 BC, and no trained anthropologist doubts these facts. A growing number, however, believe that the earliest entry of man into the New World from Siberia took place as early as about 40,000 BC. The evidence consists of large quantities of crude chipped stone implements found mostly on the surface in both North and South America. Reference that 10,000 BC, that is exactly the date or the date that Dewhurst, John Dewhurst, for the department in Ottawa, made the dig at Nootka Sound, and they determined that 10,000 AD was the period of occupation at Nootka. Now, it's not the only early occupation of the BC coast. There's another one up near Bella Coola Bella, Bella, which raised some interesting points a few years ago, and it's supposed to be much older than that. So I commend this to you, because what was happening here in terms of communication was, in fact, the migration of these people, and to be able to set down and establish their local economies. How are we going to live? Well, at Nootka, at Uquat, you had an abundance of fish, and you had a summer village at Uquat, and then you had a winter village, perhaps at Tassis or someplace inland, and you shifted back and forth according to the movements of the fish and your capability of doing so. Of course, mollusks come into this story as well. But the preservation of food to last the winter becomes an important thing. So the point here is that the communications links were all by land and by sea. And in reference to the sea, a coastal trade, no doubt, had been established from Alaska southwards through the inland passages. And the canoe was a vector for the communications and the trade that came down wonderfully from, say, Sitka, Alaska, to Puget Sound, with wonderful islands like San Juan Island being in along the way as a useful place for rest and repair. And of course, the rivalry that it entered into between these various entities was longstanding. And what is called savage warfare by the anthropologists becomes a feature of the way of communications. And the great families and the great tribes develop therefrom. So to conclude, I'm Barry Goff. I'm the creator of the Cauldron series. I'm supported by wonderful persons, including my quarterback, Greg Scott, to whom I give praise. And we hope you'll look at other episodes of the Cauldron series and see the vitality and the variety of stories that comes out of the Vancouver Island and British Columbia experiences of this amazing epoch of our history. And there's more to come. Thank you for your attention, and stay tuned. Bye-bye.